You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the October 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of the 2019 Vanity Fair Best Dressed list. The category is the originals, the Technicolor Dream Life of Tyler, the Creator. Occupation, musician, designer, home base, L.A., also known as Tyler Gregory Okonma. The look, kaleidoscopic preppy on acid. Staples, Marnie, Sunai, tomato print button-downs from his label Golf Wang. Spotted, FaceTiming with Solange at the French Open in a cotton candy pink sweater vest. Catch him next at Dodger Stadium, hosting his 8th annual Camp Flog Naw Carnival this November. And there are 7 outfits shown in the photos here, and they are all indeed kaleidoscopic preppy. Very preppy looks in the aforementioned kaleidoscopic colors. Evening Star, in wide leg velvet and bow-necked blouses, Harry Styles finds major mojo in his feminine side. Occupation, musician. Home base, London. The look, lounge act louche. Touchable suits with low-cut tanks. Austin Powers prints. Elaborate blouses. Manly heels. Significant hair mousse. The vibe, a little bit Mick, a little bit Elton. Go-to designers, Gucci, Saint Laurent. Spotted at 6:15 a.m. wearing pink trousers, posing for selfies with 300-odd screaming fans at Tokyo's Haneda Airport. And there are 3 outfits shown here. A royal blue velvet suit. The jacket is double-breasted with gold buttons. An all-black outfit with a ruffled sleeve top. And an outfit with black pants, a white t-shirt, usually meant to be made as underwear, and a red smoking jacket with white boots. And in the caption, "Why the heeled boots, Harry?" an overzealous fan once yanked his lace-up sneakers right off. In the next category for the 2019 Best Dressed list, the pros. Hader Ackerman, occupation, fashion designer, home base, Paris, Antwerp, Belgium. The look, fashion nomad. The Bogota, Colombia-born Frenchman, son of a globe-trotting cartographer, loves silk scarves, drop-crotch trousers, and wire-rimmed glasses. Spotted, Zhujing muse Tilda Swinton's silvery armor at Cannes. Posting up at Rome's La Posta Vecchia with old pals, actor-designer Waris Aluwalia and stylist Robert Rabensteiner. In the photo, he's shown wearing black shoes, lace-up shoes, with pointy toes, a little bit of a squared off at the point, no socks, rolled up, drop crotch trousers in a snake print in a black and tan color, a blue shirt, a darker blue overshirt, a scarf, a red bracelet, string bracelet, round sunglasses, and a striped knit cap. Social skills. Style star Reni Fuloayo's famed boutique is the go-to for Lagos luxury. Just ask Danai and Lupita. Occupation, founder, CEO, Alara Boutique. Home base, Lagos, Nigeria. Current obsession, magical 70s watches that close up and become beautiful bracelets. Style icon, Josephine Baker. Favorite designers, Duro Olowu, Phoebe Philo, Kenneth Ease, J.W. Anderson. Bury me in, clothes are for living. Ask me to drinks, after I just got a Valentino gown. I could turn up in that. And she's shown here wearing three different looks. A tribal print wrap skirt with a solid blue sleeveless blouse. Black trousers and a tribal print cape. Dark blue trousers and top and a green cape jacket. Laura Aria Dubreuil, pattern language, prints take me on an adventure. Occupation, founder, creative director, the Webster, LHD. Home base, LA. Treasured possession, wedding ring designed by husband Aaron Young. Lucky charm, Aurelie Biederman necklace with son's lucky number. Bury me in, my husband's silk pajama shirt. Pattern language, prints take me on an adventure. In the photos, Rebecca de Ravenel silk tiger print brings back exotic childhood fairy tales. LHD, Saint-Tropez textile conjures happy summer days at my godmother's house. Valentino 70s-inspired graphic recalls the freedom to indulge on hot nights in Capri. Valentino leopard pants plus Proenza Schuller stripes buzzes with the clash of the prints. Anastasia Barbieri, occupation, fashion director, Vogue Homme International, contributing editor, Vogue Paris. Home base, Paris. Happiest wearing, the elegance and sharpness of menswear. Trend I despise, Bermuda shorts. Treasured possession, YSL Couture black safari tunic. Sexiest of all, a white tux. Favorite designers, Dries Van Noten, Thoreau, Sartoria, Julieva. Man up. Barbieri lives in loafers, Gucci Hermes, and men's soft leather lace-ups by Brioni. And she's shown here in three different looks. One is dark blue pajama pants and top with white contrasting piping on the top, a long print dress with a dark blue jacket, and a denim pantsuit with black sweater and white shirt. Brunello Cucinelli, occupation, chairman and CEO, Brunello Cucinelli Spa, home base, Solomeo, Umbria, Italy. Trend I despise. What I like least is the color green. Style icon, Gianni Agnelli, icon of the Italian lifestyle. Treasured possession, my jackets. Great style is bearing, poise, courtesy. Favorite designer, there are many. I'll choose my master, Ralph Lauren. Bury me in a navy cashmere tuxedo. In the photo, he's shown wearing a pearl gray double-breasted jacket with dark buttons, a white shirt, black tie, blue jeans, and white shoes that buckle on the sides. And a photo of Rihanna here wearing a very bright yellow mini dress, long sleeves with an off-shoulder look. She is carrying a matching handbag and wearing ankle strap pointy toe shoes in a matching color, wearing also very large square sunglasses. Says Lisa Eisner, few celebs look as chic in rolled-out-of-bed sweats as they do in red carpet gowns. Clothes simply become cool when they're on Rihanna. continuing the 2019 Best Dressed list in the category of Hall of Fame, Rei Kawakubo. Occupation, founder, creative director Comme des Garçons. Home base, Tokyo. The look, New World Order, dark glasses, triangular bob, architectural all-black uniform. She also wears Azzedine Alaïa, Paul Harden, Celine, Louis Feathers, Nike. Spotted rarely outside of work. Her day runs 7:30 a.m. till late. Revered by Yunya Mark Musha. And she is indeed wearing an all-black outfit in the photo. A fitted black long-sleeved jacket with a Nehru collar. A long black skirt that falls just above the ankles. Black sunglasses. Black Doc Marten-type boots. Also looks as if she may have leggings that are in black on underneath the skirt. And she's carrying a red box and standing in front of a white sculpture. To continue the 2019 Best Dressed list, the category, the ensembles. Dwayne Wade, occupation, entrepreneur, former NBA All-Star, home base, Miami, L.A., happiest wearing, double-breasted red Givenchy suit, no shirt, Way of Wade gold glitter sneakers, after my last game, my one last dance in Miami. Current obsession, retirement. Trend I despise, logomania, says a lot about a person's confidence. Item I overuse, fanny packs. When we travel, I'm responsible for the travel documents. Style icon, James Bond could stand out and blend in at the same time. Lucky charm, most recently matching hearts chains I bought with my son Zion in Cannes. Favorite designers, Adrien Sauvage, D Squared 2, Tom Ford, Ralph Lauren, Pierre Moss. Overrated, belts. If your clothes fit, you do not need them. Gabrielle Union, occupation, actor, producer, home base, Miami, L.A. Trend I despise, super tiny purses. Our phones are getting bigger. And no one's leaving home without their Fenty lip gloss. We have stuff. Style icon, justice in poetic justice forever. Treasured possession, robes, slippers. When Dwayne and I are wearing them and the kids are asleep. Worst dressed moment, when Kavia James, 11 months, has projectile vomited on me. Favorite designers, Miuccia Prada, Patrick Kelly, Pier Paolo Piccioli, Christopher John Rogers. Bury me in, for starters, a full bottom brief. Style motto, but can I wear sneakers? And they are shown here in a photograph by Gillian Laub. He's wearing a red suit, no shoes. The very straight leg trousers are rolled up. And the jacket is a smoking-style jacket with a belt tied around the waist and no shirt on. Also, a gold chain with a charm. And she's wearing a dress that falls just below the knee with a split up the front, and it's gold sequins with a plunging neckline and long sleeves. She's also wearing coordinating strappy sandals in a very high heel and gold hoop earrings. the Magnificent Seven, chart-topping designer-clad K-pop phenom BTS, Hot and Hot. Suga, card obsession, accessories, so I designed a couple. Jin, item I overuse, my handsome face. Jimin, lucky charm, a $2 bill from my mother. J-Hope, style icons, ASAP Rocky, Pharrell Williams, Travis Scott. RM, items I overuse, hats, bangles, and watches. Jungkook, great style, is wearing anything you like, regardless of gender. Current obsession, the British vintage look. And they're all shown wearing various shades of black in suit ensembles with white shirts. Jason Momoa and Lisa Bonet, occupation, artist, home base, L.A. Current obsession, for Lisa Bonet, protecting my children's innocence. For Jason Momoa, ending plastic pollution, cleaning up our oceans. Item I overuse, LB, Maggie's Organics wool socks, JM, Carhartts. Overrated, LB, high heels, JM, ties. Style icons, LB, Frida Kahlo, Marchesa Cassati, JM, Toshiro Mifune, Geronimo. On men's style, LB, does it get any better than old ripped jeans and a white tee? Style motto, LB, always a bit of a rebel yell. JM, let it reflect your soul. In the photos, Mr. Pink, Momoa in Oscar night pink velvet, replete with custom scrunchie. And she's shown here also wearing a pink dress with a sort of a fishnet overlay, and the dress is sleeveless. Rick Owens and Michelle Lamy, occupation, ML, co-founder, Rick Owens label, home base, the dance floor, happiest wearing Comme des Garçons at Kawakubo-themed Met Gala, signature move, eyeliner stripe on her forehead to keep my brain balanced. Item I overuse, Rick's super thin tees in the color dust. Good luck charms, gold teeth, rings on every finger, heavy bracelets. And Owen's Proust questionnaire can be read at vf.com. In the photo, they are shown wearing, for him, an all-black suit, and for her, a long, ruffled red dress. Bella and Gigi Hadid, occupation, supermodels, home base, 35,000 feet. The look, BH, Carla Bruni, circa 1992, mini purses, biker shorts, crop tops, slid up to their gowns, GH, bombshell sportif, slip dresses, Doc Martens, inventive suits, here, artist Robert Nava for Hair and Preston, spotted, fashion week after parties, bikini-clad girls' trips. Sister act, how to Hadid in two easy steps. Step one, kicks, the bigger the better. And here she's shown wearing Fila disruptors, Fila disruptor twos, with white socks, a pink mini skirt, a pink matching jacket, and a white crop top carrying a black short shoulder purse. Step two, shades, very small, very 90s, and she's shown here wearing pink, gentle monster, halo O2s. She's also wearing a graphic print ivory blazer with coordinating trousers and square toe sandals in a coordinating navy. Social skills. The Beckhams know how to dress and how to document it. Home base, L.A., Feed Frenzy, Instagram offers 5 blue-checked views of Love V. Beckham, David and Victoria's feeds, plus those of Brooklyn, 20, Romeo, 17, and Cruz, 14. Combined followers, 99.3 million. Spot them mugging with hashtag Harper7, age 8, front row at Mum's show, biking the Puglian countryside on family vacations. And they are shown here in a family photo, wearing sort of preppy chic. Amal and George Clooney, occupation, AC, human rights lawyer, GC, actor, producer, home base, Como, Italy. The look for AC, power siren, stop sign red, Zach Posen day suits, Hollywood royalty, Stella McCartney and Ralph and Russo gowns. That hair. GC, mogul off-duty, moto jackets, regulation scruff, Armani tuxedos. Spotted, be caped at Buckingham Palace in vintage Jean-Louis Scherer. Dining with Barack and Michelle at Hotel Via d'Este. She's shown here wearing that white gown, and he's shown standing beside her wearing a tuxedo in black with white shirt, black bow tie, black shoes. To continue the 2019 Best Dressed list, Spotlight by Mary Alice Miller, rock legend, with photographs by Alex Maggioli. Rough and rare gems become exquisite showstoppers in the hands of Dior's Victoire de Castellain. Victoire de Castellain doesn't play favorites. Of the countless pieces she has designed as the creative director of Dior Fine Jewelry for more than 20 years, there isn't a ring, earring, or necklace that she prefers over another. "I would love to have one of each color for each day of the week," she says of the designs, many of which she wears in rotation in a dazzling display of the art she's been creating since she first arrived at Dior in Paris over 2 decades ago. "To me, making jewelry is a language," she says. "It's my way of expressing myself in the world." Her vocabulary is one of playful imagination and vivid opulence. Her designs, an amalgam of organic textures reminiscent of sugar crystals, coral reefs, shards of rime. The opening photo shows a workbench with mannequin hands and some sketches, along with jewelry making tools. Next photos, Art of Stone, Victoire de Castellain, photographed at Palazzo Labbia in Venice, and sketches at a workspace inside the Dior Fine Jewelry Atelier in Paris. All that glitters, earrings in yellow gold, diamonds, and emeralds in progress at the Paris Atelier. Gems, alongside a sketch for earrings in white gold, diamonds, pink sapphires, and purple garnets. A hand jewel in the making of pink gold, diamonds, and spessartite garnets. At the Jim Dior Collection celebration in Venice, a model wears white gold rings with diamonds. A white gold necklace with pink sapphire and diamonds. Guest at the celebration marking Castellain's 20th anniversary, held at the Palazzo Labbia. Each piece is de Castellain's interpretation of the world around her, which has changed radically since the beginning of her career at Chanel in 1984. "When I arrived," she says, "all of the jewelry houses were not how I imagined. The lack of women jewelry designers in 1980s Paris perplexed and motivated de Castellain. She had grown up studying the work of great early to mid-century designers, such as Suzanne Belperron and Jean Toussaint, women who created jewelry for women," she explains. "I don't know what happened in the 60s and 70s, but after that it was really a man's world, and it was boring." Now beloved for her anything but boring creations, the French designer describes her process in almost primitive terms. Visions of future pieces flash in her head. Details must be caught. She's on a constant quest for good stones. She enjoys working as if she were 5 years old, playing, but in a very conscientious way. This effervescence is on full display in her latest and largest collection, Gem Dior, a phonetic riff on Gem Dior, 99 pieces forged from a veritable treasure chest of emeralds, sapphires, diamonds, rubies, and semi-precious stones, including tanzanites and Paraiba tourmaline. In June, the collection was unveiled at a sumptuous presentation in Venice. Within a day, many of the one-of-a-kind rings, earrings, necklaces, and watches had been sold or reserved at prices reaching into the millions. But the personal value of her collection is, she says, truly sentimental. "My father is my inspiration. It's crazy, but I just realized this. He's a real 70s man, wearing rings and pendants on on metal chains, and he has this Latin exuberance. He wears jewelry in this really free way, and I put this in the jewelry without knowing it consciously. Part paternal panache, part elegant exuberance, the new collection is emblematic of de Castiane's contributions to the rarefied world of high jewelry, modern in design, timeless in appeal. A Rake's Progress. After a hard partying life as a cricket star and sex symbol, Imran Khan has transformed himself from revered sportsman into international statesman. Atish Tasir, who has known Khan since his days as a tabloid fixture, explores how an Oxford-educated playboy became the Prime Minister of Pakistan and an outspoken critic of Western decadence. Opening photo, Defender of the Faith. Imran Khan in 2012 at his home in Islamabad. "The next time you come to Pakistan," he told friends, "I will be Prime Minister." And next photos, Tiger's Lair, Khan circa 1990, and Pakistan, his sexual conquest made him a symbol of emancipatory virility. One night, the future First Lady of Pakistan had a dream. Visions and prophecies were Bushra Maneka's stock and trade, for she was a female peer, or living saint. Known as Pinky Parin to her admirers, Maneki's gift of clairvoyance had earned her a following well beyond her hometown of Pakpatan, a celebrated spiritual center 115 miles southwest of Lahore. In 2015, Maneka had added to her growing list of clients the man who was the object of her prophetic dream, Imran Khan, the legendary cricketer and most famous Pakistani alive. Spiritual guides, or peers, Khan writes in his autobiography, are quite common in Pakistan. Millions of people, particularly in rural areas of the country, follow them, consulting them on everything from religious matters to sickness and family problems. Khan was not, if a living saint, then certainly a living god. From the late 1970s, when my mother, a reporter in India, first interviewed him, to well into the 1990s, when he led the Pakistan team to a World Cup victory against England, he towered over the landscape of practically all those nations where the Union Jack had ever flown. Born in 1952 to an upper-middle-class family in Lahore, he had come of age at a time when cricket, the gentleman's game, so intimately associated with the spread of the British Empire, was turning into a blood sport, imbued with the tensions of a newly awakened post-colonial world. For teams like Pakistan, India, and the West Indies, Khan writes in his autobiography, a battle to right colonial wrongs and assert our equality was played out on the cricket field every time we took on England. Into this gladiatorial arena, shirt open, eyes bedroomy, hair long and tousled, stepped Khan. He was one of those rare figures like Muhammad Ali who emerge once a generation on the frontier of sport, sex, and politics. Imran may not have been the first player to enjoy his own cult following, writes his biographer Christopher Sanford, but he was more or less single-handedly responsible for sexualizing what had hitherto been an austere, male-oriented activity, patronized at the most devoted level by the obsessed or the disturbed. Arrestingly handsome and Oxford-educated, albeit with a third-class degree, Khan found the doors of the British aristocracy thrown open to him. Mark Shand, the brother of Camilla Parker Bowles, now the Duchess of Cornwall, was among his best friends. He was seen out on the town with Jerry Hall and Goldie Hawn. If his second wife, the television personality Reham Khan, is to be believed, he took part in a threesome with Grace Jones. The man who shunned the label of playboy, "I have never considered myself a sex symbol," he told my mother in 1983. Nonetheless, left a long line of conquest from Bollywood to Hollywood, with a pit stop in Chelsea, where his flat, with its tinted ceilings of gold silk, was one part harem, one part bordello. He had a lot of women in his life. My uncle Yusuf Salahuddin, one of Khan's best friends and a cultural institution in his own right, told me recently in Lahore, because he was a very wanted man. In India, I have seen women from the age of just 6 to 60 going crazy over him. In 1995, at age 43, Khan married Jemima Goldsmith, the daughter of the tycoon Jimmy Goldsmith, who is said to have presciently remarked of his son-in-law, "He'll make an excellent first husband." As a teenager, I remember gaping over paparazzi photos of the newlywed couple, including some of them in flagrante on a balcony in Marbella. If the fascination With Kahn's sexual prowess was fetishistic in Britain, it was edged with racial pride in Pakistan. As Mohsen Hamid, the country's most famous writer, told me in Lahore, Imran Khan was a symbol of emancipatory virility. In the mid-1990s, there was not a cloud on Khan's horizon. He had won the World Cup. He had married an alluring social beauty. He had, in memory of his mother, who died of cancer in 1985, opened Pakistan's first hospital dedicated to the treatment of that disease. It was a massive philanthropic gesture and the crowning achievement of a life showered with gifts. At that juncture, it might well have been asked what a clairvoyant from a small town in Pakistan had to offer Khan that he didn't already have. The short answer is politics. In 1996, after years of turning down pleas from established politicians and military dictators eager to align themselves with his celebrity, Khan launched his own political party. In its first election, the Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf Party, or PTI, which translates as the Movement for Justice, won 0 seats in parliament. 5 years later, Khan won 1 seat, his own. Even by 2013, with his personal popularity at an all-time high, the PTI won only 35 seats. For 20 years, he had been telling his friends and well-wishers that the next time you come to Pakistan, I will be prime minister. But 4 elections had come and gone, 2 marriages had collapsed in their wake, and the quest of this aging playboy to be his country's premier was no longer its end. It was then, or not long after that, that Bushra Maneka had her dream. Khan, like a real-world version of Stannis Baratheon, desperately consulting the Red Woman in Game of Thrones, had begun to see Pinky for spiritual guidance. The clairvoyant's usual fee for making the impossible possible, a senior media figure in Karachi told me, on condition of anonymity, was great vats of cooked meat. These, he explained, over a Japanese meal, she fed to the jinns she kept at her disposal. Jinns? I asked, wondering if I had misheard. She has 2 jinns, the media man said, serving me some more soba noodles. Then he came to the surreal story that is on the lips of everyone in Pakistan, from senior diplomats and ministers to journalists and entertainers. Although Maneka has dismissed it as mere rumor, the story has attained the status of fable, a supernatural tale that seeks to illuminate a deeper truth. Once Maneka had her prophetic vision, the media veteran told me no amount of cooked meat would suffice to fulfill Khan's ambition. The voice in her dream was clear. If Imran Khan was to be prime minister, it was imperative he be married to the right woman. In other words, a member of Maneka's own family. In one version of this torrid tale, Maneka offered her sister to Khan. In another, it was her daughter. Either way, Khan demurred. Then Maneka went away to dream again. This time, however, she was no bystander to someone else's vision. The voice in her head told her that she, Bushra Maneka, a married woman and a mother of 5, was the wife Imran Khan needed. What Maneka now wanted from Khan was what every woman had ever wanted from him. She wanted him. Khan had never set eyes on Maneka, for she consulted her followers from behind a veil. But this time, he acceded to her vision. The stars aligned, and Maneka's husband, a customs official, agreed to give her a divorce, praising Khan as a disciple of our spiritual family. In February 2018, cricketer and clairvoyant were married in a private ceremony. 6 months later, Imran Khan was elected Prime Minister of Pakistan, and Pinky Pierney, A character who would stretch the limits of Salman Rushdie's imagination was its first lady. On the burning hot morning in April, when my flight landed at Allama Iqbal International Airport in Lahore, I asked a man with a thickly dyed mustache sitting next to me whether I needed to fill out an entry card. "This is Imran Khan's Pakistan," he responded enthusiastically. Khan had promised a new Pakistan, and presumably one feature of this utopia, my seatmate implied, is that nobody has to fill out tiresome paperwork anymore. Khan, both as candidate and prime minister, sounds like populist everywhere, now inveighing against westernized, dollar-addicted elites, now promising to fix the problems of one of South Asia's slowest-growing economies by bringing home magical amounts of black money squirreled away in foreign bank accounts. But as much as his rhetoric resembles that of other populists, from Narendra Modi next door in India to Erdogan in Turkey and Bolsonaro in Brazil, there is one important difference. Khan is not of the people. If anything, he belongs to an elite even more glamorous and rarefied than the one he routinely attacks. As he said himself in an article he wrote for Arab News in 2002, "I was smoothly moving to becoming a Pukka Brown Sahib, a colonial term denoting a native more English than the English. After all," he added, "I had the right credentials in terms of school, university, and above all, acceptability in the English aristocracy." Unlike other populists in the developing world, Khan is a man guessing at the passions of people he does not actually represent. Like Trump or the Brexiteers, he underwent a Damascene conversion, which, as he wrote, caused him to turn his back on Brown Sahib culture and throw in his lot with the real Pakistan. The man after whom the airport in Lahore is named was easily the single greatest influence in Khan's transformation from louche fixture of the demi-monde to political revolutionary. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.